I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
G8 leaders are talking about democracy over lunch today at their Sea Island summit, specifically President Bush's Middle East democracy plan, which already has some Arab and European leaders bristling. And joining us on the line is Mark Smith. He's covering the summit for the Associated Press Radio. Welcome, Mark.
And good day to you, Gail.
And do we know exactly what is in the president's plan?
Well, he's outlined this several times, and of course the G8 leaders are talking about what the G8 specifically can do to aid democracy. They're talking about basically encouraging Arab governments to reform, to open up to the rule of law, to establish courts and legislatures that are more accountable to the public. Obviously, this is a message that has had something of a mixed response. It's not only had a mixed response elsewhere, it's going to have something of a mixed response here. The Jordanians are here. Obviously, the new Iraqi president, Ghazi al-Yawar, is here. But I think this summit is kind of notable for who is not here. The Saudi Arabians declined an invitation to come. So did the Egyptians. President Hosni Mubarak said he couldn't fit it into his schedule. Morocco's king is not here. So there are a number of rather large-scale Arab absences from this luncheon summit discussion of the president's initiative.
And, of course, many people are saying that there can be no progress in the region until the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is resolved.
Yeah, absolutely. And, in fact, a couple of the Arab leaders who are here for this session said just that. That it's fine to talk about, reform in the Arab world, but really the big problem in terms of even selling any sort of reform to the Arab populace is that the Arab-Israeli dispute, the Palestinian issue, is still first and foremost in the Arab mind, and until that is removed as an obstacle, progress is just not going to be made.
Well, one of the bright spots for the administration, of course, was yesterday's unanimous vote by the UN Security Council. Will that help give the president something else that he can point to as progress once this summit is over?
Well, he's certainly pointing to that and saying, here is the international community finally coming back together with the coalition that went to war in Iraq. Tony Blair was saying to us this morning that, now the terrorists, the Saddam loyalists who he blames for the attacks and the violence in Iraq, they need to know they're no longer just fighting America and Britain, that they're really up against the world community. Now, that said, in a practical sense, it's not clear how much help that's going to be for President Bush. The administration some weeks ago gave up on the idea that this new UN resolution was going to result in any major new infusion of troops. Bush is talking about a larger role for NATO today, but that's really just going to be a logistical role, perhaps in training Iraqi security forces. There are not going to be any big new contingents of foreign troops coming into Iraq.
And in fact, Spain said that they're not sending more troops back either. What else is on the G8 agenda?
Well, it's a typically broad agenda. Keep in mind, of course, Gail, this is an economic summit. So the first meeting this morning talked about the world economy, which is improving somewhat. Certainly it's in better shape than it was last year at Evian, France, when these folks met. But they're also talking about things like weapons proliferation. The G8 is talking about increasing their efforts to stop the shipment of deadly weapons around the world. They're talking about poverty, new effort to enlist the private sector in fighting poverty. They're talking about disease, too. You, of course, heard about the Bush administration's $15 billion anti-AIDS effort. Well, there's talk here of establishing a World AIDS Consortium that might help create a vaccine.
Well, Mark, we'll let you get back to work. Thank
All
you
right.
so much.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
Mark Smith is a reporter for Associated Press Radio.
The two major Kurdish parties in Iraq are threatening to not participate in the new Iraqi government, a move which would amount to secession. Kurdish leaders had demanded that the UN resolution on Iraq endorse the interim constitution, which guarantees Kurdish rights. But Iraq's leading Shiite clerics said there could be trouble if the UN Security Council recognized the interim agreement, and the new resolution passed yesterday seemed to respond to his concern, eliminating any mention of the old accord. Well, Lourdes Navarro is covering the story for the Associated Press in Baghdad. And Lourdes, first of all, remind us, what is this older interim agreement that they are referring to?
Well, this is the interim constitution that at the time was touted by the coalition provisional authorities and the governing council, which helped draft it, as a major step towards setting Iraq on the path to democracy. It was said that it was the most progressive document in the Middle East guaranteeing freedom of religion, guaranteeing minority rights. And instead, what has happened is that the Kurds, which really at the time put a lot of pressure to have federalism included as one of the main stipulations as how the country would end up being governed.
In other words, they would have the right to keep some sort of control over their territories?
Basically, that's right. I mean, the Kurds have been autonomous now for many years, and they want to make sure that they keep some of that autonomy in the new government. They are very afraid, is not too light a word, that the Shiite majority will exercise too much influence over the Kurdish areas. And so they had put a few provisions in the interim constitution that would guarantee their rights in that respect. The fact that it hasn't been included in the UN resolution that's just been passed is a real blow to them. And the main two parties, the Kurdistan Democratic Party and the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, are having discussions at the moment as to whether they really should withdraw from the interim government of which they form a part.
Now, the Kurds, we should say, are Kurds first and foremost, but they are also largely Sunni. And now we've mentioned that the Shiite cleric has said that he will cause trouble if the UN Security Council does recognize the interim agreement that guarantees the Kurds the rights they want. Why would he say that?
Well, Shiite cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Husseini al-Sistani is a familiar name around these parts because he has really interjected many times in different processes that have taken place here to try and guarantee the rights of the Shiite majority. And he does not want one of the specific provisions that the Kurds managed to get in, which was the Kurds would be guaranteed a veto right over any permanent constitution that would take place at a later date. And the fact of the matter is that the Grand Ayatollah does not want the Kurds to have that kind of power over the Shiite majority.
Is there any chance that the Kurds will refuse to participate in this new government if an agreement isn't reached? And what does that mean?
Well, if the two Kurdish parties decided not to participate in the new government, it would be an extreme blow to the new interim government that has been put in place. This is a non-elected body that was appointed by the United Nations and the United States, and it is struggling to get credibility here. Its predecessor, the Governing Council, did not have any credibility with the people of Iraq, and this is going to be a very volatile period. So if we had two of the main parties, minority parties, withdrawing from this government, it would send a clear signal that at least some of the people in Iraq do not support it, and that would certainly undermine the road ahead towards democratic elections before January 2005.
What do you think will happen?
Well, I think indeed they will reach some sort of agreement. I think a lot of it may be grandstanding. I think the Kurds are upset, but I think that there will be some kind of agreement reached here on the ground that will satisfy perhaps not completely, but certainly partially both parties.
Lourdes Navarro covers Iraq for the Associated Press. Lourdes, thank you for talking to us.
Thank you.
Some fireworks yesterday at the Senate Judiciary Committee as Attorney General John Ashcroft was called to testify about Justice Department memos that argued U.S. officials can sidestep existing laws against torture. Ashcroft refused to hand over copies of those memos and further astonished some senators by refusing to offer a legal justification for that decision. The result was some acrimonious testimony.
I am refusing to disclose these memos because I believe it is essential to the operation of the executive branch that the president have the opportunity to get information from his attorney general that is confidential, and that the responsibility to do that is a function of the executive branch and a necessity that is protected by the doctrine of the separation of powers in the Constitution.
Mr. Attorney
and,
General.
For that reason, and that is the reason for which I have not delivered to the Congress or the members of the Senate these memos.
Mr. Attorney General, with all due respect, your personal belief is not a law, and you are not citing a law, and you are not claiming executive privilege. And frankly, that is what contempt of Congress is all about.
Charles Tiefer is with us on the line. He's a professor of law at the University of Baltimore and for many years served as legal counsel to the Senate and House. He joins us from Washington. And Charles, this sounded like a real constitutional confrontation, but was it, or do attorneys general and Congress often lock horns in this way?
These constitutional confrontations are quite rare. This last happened twice in the 1990s, twice in the last 15 years. It's very rare.
Well, now, Senator Durbin hit the roof when Ashcroft failed to explain a legal justification for not wanting to hand over the documents. Senators Biden and Kennedy were also tough on him. But they're all Democrats. I mean, does this go beyond partisanship?
Oh, definitely, because both the Democrats and the Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee, knowing the importance of the subject being covered with Ashcroft and knowing that they have to perform their constitutional oversight responsibilities, both parties know they have to do this.
So if he had claimed executive privilege, what does that mean?
It means he goes to President Bush, as they did in 2002, and says, Mr. President, you're the only one who can formally claim executive privilege. Will you sign the piece of paper that says you're claiming executive privilege? And then the president, who is the only one who has the constitutional responsibility to claim executive privilege, does so. I myself was receiving telephone calls from lawyers working with the Senate Judiciary Committee who were astonished that he was proceeding the way he was and were trying to figure out what you do when there's, in effect, a claim of executive privilege, but there's a refusal to go get the president to authorize it.
Do you think Congress will find him in contempt?
Well, I think there'll be a couple of days in which the heat builds, and you start seeing the focus be both on the Democrats who emphasize the claim informally of executive privilege, and the independent Republicans in the Senate, like Lindsey Graham and Arlen Specter, who are in a tough position and who don't want they're having to choose, walk a fine line between doing their job as senators and performing oversight and being disloyal to their party. And so you're going to see the heat turning up on them in the next couple of days.
Charles, thank you.
You're welcome.
Charles Tiefer is a former counsel to the Senate and the House of Representatives.
And this note, the Associated Press is reporting that from 1997 to 2003, the Defense Department wasted an estimated $100 million on unused airline tickets. Members of Congress ordered the General Accounting Office to investigate the Defense Department airline policy. According to the GAO report, it was so lax that investigators posing as defense employees requested tickets from the Defense Department, showed up at the airline counter, and got them, no questions asked. To make matters worse, the department often reimbursed employee expense accounts for tickets that had already been paid for by the Defense Department. The department relied on employees to return their unused tickets. They didn't, and it added up to $100 million. It's not known if the Defense Department also squandered $100 million worth of frequent flyer miles.
Just ahead, is the Democratic Party emerging from an identity crisis? There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The deep division between party lines is emerging once again as Republicans and Democrats voice their opinions about former President Ronald Reagan's legacy. Some say that this type of partisan politics came to the fore while Reagan was in office. But the political conversation then was more civil, less angry. Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion would like to see civil conversation make a comeback. But to do so, he says, Democrats have to have a unified, well-articulated voice. He writes about all of this in his new book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
I'm tempted to say, tell us how you really feel, but I think you pretty much did that in your title.
It is a fun title, and they did a nice job on the cover putting it on a political button. It does seem like that sort of title. And I guess it comes from a sense of frustration about the direction of politics over the last several years. The book is very tough on President Bush. It wouldn't be surprising from that title. It's also tough on the Democrats for taking such a long time to become a coherent opposition. I argue in the book that Democrats have spent so much time saying who they're not that nobody knows who they are.
Well, among Democrats, is the problem, as you see it, a lack of ideas, or is it that the Democrats just haven't been able to find a really charismatic leader to point the way?
Well, they certainly had a reasonably charismatic leader despite his problems in Bill Clinton. I think it's the Democrats need to get out of a series of sort of rote arguments they've been having for 20 years. In the book, I have a list of what I call the wrong stuff and the right stuff. And the wrong stuff are just a whole series of arguments that are useless. I mean, big government versus small government. This is a useless debate. I think the issue is whose side is the government going to be on? And that's a much more constructive way to frame this. Or, you know, are you pro-business or anti-business? Well, business has done very well under Democratic administrations or Republicans. The issue is what kind of regulations do you need to protect outsiders from insiders? And I think there are a whole lot of these debates the Democrats just got locked into that they have to get out of. I think the good news is, and maybe Democrats in the long run will owe President Bush a debt, they're breaking out of some of this. There is more solidarity, but I'm arguing that change has to accelerate.
Well, and you can see some of that in the language that's used. I'm thinking here of the L word, liberal. It's been a word that Democrats have been recoiling from for some time now because it has been used against them. And the term that you prefer is progressive patriotism. Where do you draw the distinction between progressive patriotism and the old style liberalism?
Well, in the first place, I think that people shouldn't allow the other side to demonize a word. I actually wrote a piece for the American Legion magazine some months back in defense of liberalism. But progressive patriotism is, I think, the right idea for this moment, especially after 9/11. I will confess that some of the inspiration for the idea of progressive patriotism came from compassionate conservatism in this sense that David Frum, a very good speechwriter for President Bush, wrote a book called The Right Man. And he didn't like compassionate conservatism. He has a line where he said, like conservatism but hate arguing about abortion, try our new compassionate conservatism, great ideological taste with less controversy. And he said, what would liberals feel like if they had to put the word patriotic in front of the word liberal? And I thought about that and I said, actually, there's nothing wrong with putting the word patriotic in front of liberal.
The third piece of your subtitle is The Politics of Revenge. How do you see that playing out in the 2004 presidential election?
Well, for Democrats, the plus side of the politics of revenge is I don't think their party has ever been united. I think if John Kerry said, I want to repeal the whole New Deal, Democrats would say he's only doing that for the election. It's okay. So I do think you have that kind of solidarity. But I think after the election, I think there are an awful lot of people in both parties and in the middle of the political spectrum who are really tired of this polarization. I think it is a good time to think about what would a government of national unity look like. And that sounds like a kind of vague concept. But there are a lot of people in the center and who are progressive. There are a lot of moderate Republicans out there whom I don't think like this polarization any more than a lot of people in the Democratic Party do. And so I think that does create an opportunity were Kerry to win the election, and I think it's a logical theme for him to talk about what national unity would look like as opposed to this kind of polarization.
Do you think that this kind of polarization is damaging? Is this something we need to be alarmed about?
Well, polarization is two-sided. I mean, on the one hand, when you have this kind of polarized politics, a lot of people believe some important things are at stake and they're having a real argument. And I am never against real argument. That's a good thing for a democracy. I think the trouble here is a lot of time it passes from real argument to something very ugly, and it's not about anything. It's almost Seinfeld politics.
Well, it's also different from what we've had historically. The passing of Ronald Reagan certainly reminded us that there was a time when people could have very passionately held opinions, argue about them all day long, and then at some point they shook hands and tried to work it out.
Right. I mean, I had, as a lot of people in my point of view did, have some real problems with Ronald Reagan. But I think a couple of things that we looked back on fondly, one was a general sunniness where he didn't seem to convey hatred of the people who disagreed with him. He and Tip O'Neill from Massachusetts got along rather well. Secondly, Ronald Reagan was an interesting figure because he really spent a lot of his political life as a Democrat. And he spoke like a Democrat in a way I don't think any Republican has since. And that itself created a different kind of feeling about politics. No doubt he was a very conservative Republican, but he understood the rhythms and the language of being a Democrat, and that created a different feeling about politics.
Finally, looking ahead to this summer, at some point John Kerry's going to have to pick a running mate. Who would be on your short list?
My short list is probably not that different from anyone else's. I'm intrigued by the idea of John McCain. partly because I believe in this idea of creating a greater sense of national solidarity. And, of course, having two Vietnam veterans on a ticket has some real power. Like a lot of people, I was very impressed with John Edwards' primary campaign and his call for one America instead of two Americas, one for the privileged and one for the rest. The rest of the names, I think, are logical. Richard Gephardt has a lot of experience, would not cause trouble for the ticket, and is from the Midwest. Governor Richardson of New Mexico is from an important region. People have talked about Wesley Clark and some others. But I have to confess, I have never been very good at predicting vice presidents. In 1996, I urged Bob Dole to pick John McCain as his vice president, but the Republicans didn't listen to me.
Can't imagine why.
I thought it was a good suggestion.
Thanks, E.J.
Thank you.
E.J. Dionne is author of the new book, Stand Up, Fight Back, Republican Toughs, Democratic Wimps, and the Politics of Revenge. To hear the complete interview with E.J., check out our website at here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Go, hey, hey! Ho, ho! Tommy Menino's gotta go, hey, hey! Ho, ho!
Unionized city workers led by the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association are back at the Fleet Center today to continue their picketing over stalled contract negotiations. The battle between the unions and Mayor Thomas Menino's office forced organizers of the Democratic National Convention to halt the opening day of convention preparations yesterday. Mayor Menino said despite looming Democratic convention deadlines, he could not cave in to union demands for more money.
We are looking at crunch time, but I also have an obligation to the people of Boston also. I cannot spend money that I don't have in the city. I have a responsibility financially. I know what we can afford and contract. I don't want to be a city that's taken over by a state government because the financial crisis may be in. I'm not going to mortgage my city's future.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish was at the Fleet Center yesterday. She has this report.
Construction in the Fleet Center was hamstrung yesterday by union workers, police, firefighters, EMTs, and municipal workers who lined the three major passageways to the building. They jeered carpenters and electrical workers who tried to make their way through the line.
Don't go in! Don't go in!
Some, like this carpenter, who would not be identified, were turned away.
Well, we were surprised they were here this early. Well, we weren't surprised at the way they reacted. I mean, we would do the same thing. We're in unions, too, so we all got to stick together.
The carpenter and several co-workers were later let in by their boss under a barrage of boos. Drivers for a moving company circled the building without stopping. Their boss later said the Teamsters would never cross a picket line. Meanwhile, union workers also crowded the back entrance to the building and started banging the sides of a panel truck from Shamet Design and Construction. The firm is leading the Fleet Center's transformation from sports arena to national convention-ready venue. Commuters emptied out of the North Station subway stop into the outstretched arms of union workers handing out pamphlets and waving anti-Menino signs. Many gave the thumbs up or cheered the union on, while some, like Bob Larkin of Beverly, said he's not sure if centering the protest on the convention is a wise idea.
I don't know if it's serving their purpose. You know, it isn't fair that they're holding the convention captive. We're making enough sacrifices surrounding this not to have more disruptions here. Let's get this thing over with and get back to our normal lives.
But many of these protesting workers are ardent supporters of the Democratic Party and of Bay State Senator and presidential hopeful John Kerry, says Susanna Sagat, president of the Municipal Workers Union, the SEIU.
It's not about John Kerry,
but it's his party in his hometown, and you guys are delaying it.
The mayor is delaying it. We're not delaying it. The mayor is delaying it. And we're going to reach out to everyone who could put pressure on him to pay attention. He can't just go around all day cutting ribbons and doing ceremonial stuff. He needs to pay attention to his workers.
It is this mutual concern for the city, the party, and the candidate that will carry the day, says Steve Grossman, former Democratic National Committee chairman.
The organized labor movement is going to be a critical ingredient from an organizing standpoint in helping John Kerry win a great victory on November 2nd. So that we need organized labor to be part and parcel of this convention in a way that is productive and not adversarial. But at the end of the day, I believe people will come together at a moment that is important to allow this work to continue without jeopardizing the Democratic National Convention and its success.
Now, with less than 2 months to go before the convention, the city's negotiations with its unions appear to have dissolved into finger-pointing. Mayor Menino says the union leading the demonstration, the Boston Police Patrolmen's Association, is thwarting the negotiation process and should agree to go before independent arbitrators. The association, however, refuses, saying it's been burned by that process before. Menino says he will consult with city lawyers about whether demonstrators are staying within agreed boundaries. And despite the fact that some unions say they won't cross picket lines, the mayor says he expects workers contracted with the DNC to meet those obligations.
WBUR's Audie Cornish reporting from the Fleet Center in downtown Boston.
In New York, the other city that's hosting a national political convention this summer, tensions are also heating up between organized labor and City Hall. Home health care workers are wrapping up a 3-day strike today. Daycare workers are starting one. And teachers, police, and firefighters held a huge rally yesterday to send a message to New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Joining us on the line is reporter David Andriotta, who covers City Hall for the New York Sun. Hi, David.
Hi, Gail.
Daycare workers, home health care workers not on the job. What are people doing who rely on these folks so they can get to work?
Well, actually, the daycare workers are telling parents to stay home for the day and take care of their children as a way of putting pressure on City Hall. Home care workers, those who rely on them, were equally distressed over the past 3 days, although certain unions that cover the home health care workers did strike deals with City Hall, and there are a total of 23,000 home care workers, and I believe there are about 12,000 who are still striking today.
And, David, why all this labor unrest now? Is this in any way related to the political convention coming there, or was it simply something that had been building for some time?
I think it's something that's been brewing for a long time, Gail. These unions have been without contracts for 2 and 3 years, daycare workers for almost 5 years. So it's really just been simmering.
Mayor Bloomberg is suggesting that in order for people to get raises, they should become more productive. Explain that one for me.
Well, he's looking for productivity increases. One of his mantras is do more with less. The response from the unions is we have. Mayor Bloomberg is in a very sensitive situation with the big three unions, teachers, cops, and firefighters, because he is constantly touting the city's safety record. He's also come under political heat for closing firehouses under budget cuts last year, and he's made education a centerpiece of his administration. So, you know, when you look at the factors, yes, crime is down in the city. Firefighters seem to be doing just as good of a job. The response times have only climbed up incrementally, and teachers are working with what they have. So the unions are at a loss when Bloomberg asks them to do more with less. They say that they already have.
How much do these folks make on average?
Well, firefighters and police both start at about $37,000. Teachers start at around $39,000.
I was going to ask, how can anyone live on $38,000 in New York City?
It is very difficult. A lot of these firefighters claim that they are taking second jobs. Police officers do the same thing. Teachers in the summer do the same thing. So, you know, they're really moonlighting.
But exactly, they're moonlighting or they're making extra money from overtime?
Well, that's the administration's argument, especially when it comes to police. The NYPD, when you join the NYPD, yeah, you start at a low salary, but the argument is that your overtime is almost unlimited. Teachers, they have, I think, the least recourse.
David, thank you.
Thank you, Gail.
David Andreotta is a staff reporter for the New York Sun.
Still to come, a new film gives the West a behind-the-scenes look at Al Jazeera television.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Mourners hoping to pay their respects at the casket of former President Ronald Reagan will experience long lines and tight restrictions. Homeland Security has designated the next 3 days in Washington a national special security event to protect against terrorist threats. President Bush has ordered a nationwide shutdown of the federal government on Friday, the same day thousands of local police will be deployed across Washington, some as rooftop snipers, some with bomb-sniffing dogs. Dwight Pettiford is acting chief of the Park Police. He's on the Ellipse meeting with White House officials. And, Dwight, what are some of the changes that will be implemented this week because of security issues?
First of all, people will see fencing along the procession route, which will you'll have to stay behind the fencing as the procession passes. But it will give you an opportunity to observe the procession along Constitution Avenue.
What kind of restrictions will be placed on people as they go into the rotunda?
All right, they can't carry backpacks, or they only need to bring things that they have to have with them to go through the procession line. Mm. Don't bring anything that would slow the process.
Yeah, because it's going to be screened like a like an airport screening?
That's a perfect analogy. You should treat this as if you're flying.
Right. We understand no flowers, no food, no large pocketbooks, no cameras. How do these security measures that are going to be taken this week compare to, let's say, President Johnson's state funeral in 1973, the last state funeral in the Capitol?
That's a great question. I was not here during President Johnson's funeral, but I've just spoken to some of our employees who were here. Things are more than double in the level of security that we're taking now because of 9/11 and some other incidents that occurred in history. So we take many more precautions. We use more things with technology and more personnel.
I understand that the Metropolitan Police have radiation detection. There's going to be chemical suits on some officers. You know, back in Johnson's era, I think there were just police with handguns.
That's correct. But now we have many tools in our basket.
Yeah, we understand that there's a 138-page book that's been written since Reagan was president, and that's standard. Plans for this funeral date back to 1981. What are some of the things that are being added last minute? I know you're having this meeting even as we speak.
At this last minute, we are making some special accommodations for the family members. We're standing at the point of the exchange of the casket from the hearse to the caisson. And this is one of the sites that people want, if they want to see history start, this is a great location.
Washington National Cathedral, where the actual service will be held, we understand is at a modified level 3 security, a pretty high level. This is the first presidential funeral there since Eisenhower's in 69. How securable is the National Cathedral?
Right. We have techniques from the law enforcement community to be able to do things that people will not notice and to make it a very safe location. And we've employed those. And that's something that we do for a lot of events where we have dignitaries attending.
Yeah. I understand that you're not going to really say what the route is that the casket's going to take from the airport to the Capitol until the last minute. But I guess it's just common sense that you're not going to move too quickly in Washington, D.C. over the next few days, especially on Friday.
That's correct. We're asking people to take public transportation, and the government is federal government and local government is closed on Friday to pay respect, to allow the workers to pay respect to President Reagan. But it's also to reduce the traffic flow.
Well, Dwight Pettiford, again, thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Okay, thank you.
Dwight Pettiford, acting chief of the United States Park Police, speaking to us from the Ellipse in Washington, D.C.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here in... I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
This news note, 17 suspected Islamic militants with ties to al-Qaeda are in custody in Belgium and Italy today. Those arrested in 2 days of raids include Egyptians, Moroccans, Palestinians, and Jordanians. Police say one of the suspects is thought to be a ringleader of the March 11th Madrid train bombings. Spanish authorities call him Mohammed the Egyptian. He allegedly conducted training courses at al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan.
Earlier this week, while at the G8 summit, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice accused the Arab satellite TV channel Al Jazeera of inaccurate reporting and said that the network presented a biased portrayal of the Middle East. Such accusations are not new to the satellite network, but a new documentary, Control Room, seeks to shed some light into Al Jazeera, the favorite channel of 40 million Arab viewers, as it covered one of its biggest stories, the Iraq War. Control Room opens in selected cities on Friday, and filmmaker Jahan Nujaim joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
And welcome back to Boston, I should say, as a Harvard graduate and someone who spent considerable amount of time here.
Definitely. This is a place where I have very, very fond memories of Boston. It's very good to be back.
As an Egyptian-American who was educated at Harvard, when you began to make this film, did you have an agenda going in?
I think it's difficult to have an agenda when your beliefs are being challenged all the time. I mean, I filmed a lot of the anti-war protests, and I'm definitely somebody that doesn't believe in violence as a way of solving problems. And then I went back to Cairo, and I had friends of mine who were Iraqi friends who were excited about the fact that the U.S. was going in to remove Saddam Hussein. That's why I chose characters who were, I think, struggling to figure out what was actually going on, and through them have a better understanding of the situation.
How were you able to persuade Al Jazeera to open its doors to you?
That was tough. They didn't. I wrote emails and letters, and they just were not interested. They said, "Come back after the war when we're not so busy." So I went in. I was granted a meeting through with the general manager, and I said, "Look, just give me a couple days to hang out and meet people." And pretty soon after that, Hassan Ibrahim, who is the very funny, interesting, complex guy, half British, half Sudanese, used to work at the BBC. So was somebody that was interesting to be around during such an intense period like this. And he was really the person that said, look, I'll go talk to the management. I think that this is interesting what you guys are trying to do. And he got us access.
And he certainly has a very pronounced, shall we say, point of view. We hear some of that in the film. Let's listen to an excerpt.
Of course, we'll get grief from the Americans for showing these pictures because we'll be inciting rebellion and we'll be basically instigating anti-American sentiments. I mean, I'm sorry. They can't have the cake and eat it. I mean, yeah, okay, you are the most powerful nation on earth. I agree. You can defeat everybody. I agree. You can crush everybody. I agree. But don't ask us to love it as well.
One of the things that's interesting to me in watching the film is how much you see Al Jazeera taking heat from everybody on all sides, which generally those of us in journalism take as a sign that we're doing it right if we're making everybody mad.
I always knew them as a channel that was very heavily criticized by the Arab world. When I grew up in Egypt, I grew up with state-run television news. And then when I came back in 97, they had been launched in 96. And they were starting to talk about issues that had never been debated or talked about before, like the role of women in the government, the role of religion in the government, what kind of roles should they play. And these were previously considered taboo topics. So they, to me, were these people that were crossing red lines and pushing boundaries and were kind of a revolutionary station. And then when I went back to the States, that's when I started kind of hearing about them soon after September 11th in the States as the mouthpiece of Osama bin Laden and Taliban TV and, you know, enemy number one. So I was curious to find out who are these people behind the channel.
Where do they get their money?
Well, initially funded by the Emir of Qatar, and they're still under a grant from the Emir of Qatar. they maintain that their editorial line is not affected by it. The general perception in the Arab world is because the Qatari government is so friendly to the U.S. government that any pressure that comes on Al Jazeera is actually to be more pro-American and more supportive of the United States than anything else.
Which is so interesting because obviously in this country it's a completely different perspective. And I was reminded of Walter Lippmann's observation back in 1922 in his book Public Opinion when he said that people form their opinions based on the pictures in their heads. And in this case, the pictures that Al Jazeera viewers get are much more graphic than what we see on American television. And I wonder how much that influences public opinion in the Arab world.
I think it plays a big role. And a lot of the film gets back to images and what kind of images are we seeing. And these are good images, these are bad images. I think the image has become really, really important in terms of what forms people's, you know, perceptions. And so, yeah, I think that showing those graphic images is what really upsets the U.S. administration because you can't deny it. It is making people very upset. But Jazeera would say, look, we're not the people that are doing this. We're just filming what's happening. And you can't lie to the people in this way.
Maybe it's not such a good thing that Americans are getting such a sanitized version of what's happening.
Well, actually, this is interesting because it's what Lieutenant Rushing says, the American military press officer, has said in an interview has said to me since then, in a way, in the U.S., war is very sanitized, and it gives an approval of war that we shouldn't have. And he said that at Al Jazeera, they show the grisly images, and it makes you feel sick to your stomach, it makes you feel queasy, but it reminds you what war is really about, and we should be knowing what the troops are being sent out to do.
And also, it was a little startling what we heard from the U.S. information officer, Lieutenant Rushing.
It benefits Al Jazeera to play to Arab nationalism because that's their audience, just like Fox plays to American patriotism for the exact same reason, American nationalism, because that's their demographic audience and that's what they want to see.
That's something that most Americans would really necessarily think about in those terms.
And it makes sense. I mean, Samir was the senior producer in the film, and he says, look, we have an audience, just like any other American news station has an audience. And if you don't keep your audience, then, you know, you go down the drain. We're a business, and we do appeal to an audience.
And finally, what do you feel now, having spent all this time as a fly on the wall at Al Jazeera, a fly on the wall with a camera, I should note, do you think that it is an honest reflection of Arab opinion that is trying to show all sides, or is it mostly telling its 40 million viewers what they want to hear?
Oh, that's a tough question. I think that they really do, just by the fact that they broadcast all of the Bush speeches live, all the Powell speeches live, all of the U.S. administration speeches live. There was where Rumsfeld had to speak about the prison abuses. They broadcast this live on Al Jazeera. And I asked Samir, you know, why did you guys do this? And he said, well, I think it's really important for Arabs to see, because they know that this happens across Arab prisons. But he said, I think that it's important to see that in a democracy, there's a system of accountability, and that you're seeing a very high level official going kind of on trial and having to explain himself, and you would never see that in the Arab world. So when you see that, you think they're a very positive force in the Arab world. On the other hand, are they appealing to an audience in that they're going to focus on Iraq and focus on Palestine? Definitely, because that's what their audience wants to see.
Jahan Nujaim, thank you so much and congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jahan Nujaim's film Control Room opens in selected cities around the country on Friday. For more information, you can go to our website, here-now.org.
Here Now Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, Jordana Gustafson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.